This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hi, this is Gary Clinton, and welcome to Night Transmissions. This is show 36 now, and we're going to start off with an episode from Escape for April the 9th of 1949 called When the Man Comes, Follow Him. This is the Les Crutchfield adaptation of a short story by Ralph Bates. It opens up in San Francisco where a criminal, a pretty big time criminal in the story, he's the head of a syndicate who you would say has pretty much everything going for him except for one minor problem. He's blind. But he does have a trusty right-hand man named Pascal, who's about as loyal as you could possibly hope for somebody in this position to be. He's there, right there, night and day. And on one particular day, the blind mobster gets a completely unexpected visit from his brother. His brother, who has never really had any use for him, but that really didn't stop him from occasionally borrowing money. This time, however, his brother, Mark, is in really bad shape. Appears at the door, dazed and wounded and mumbling about a king's treasure. And his map that he has is the key to it all. He wants his brother to have it and gives it to him just before he died. So, in that apartment in San Francisco, begins another trek into the Arizona desert looking for the lost Dutchman's mine. This is pretty well done.
Tired of the everyday routine.
Sit back and enjoy it, and I'll be back in a little while.
Ever dream of a life of romantic adventure? Want to get away from it all?
We offer you Escape! Today, with Paul Dubov, starred as Pascal, we escape to the Arizona desert and a lost treasure of $1 million, as Ralph Bates told it in his most unusual story, When the Man Comes, Follow Him.
I was wrong. I know that now. But what good's it do? How could you tell dead men that it's all your fault and you're sorry? No matter what you tell them, they're still dead. So what's the use? It never would have happened if we hadn't got mixed up in this superstition business. We was going along fine. All the other boys in Frisco respected us, stayed out of our territory at least most of the time. That was on account of the boss, Mr. Heineman. He was too smart for them, and they knew it. Smart and a great guy along with it. Of course, some people might call him an ordinary racketeer, but he wasn't like that. Nobody could have treated me no better. And he was cultured, too, loved music. Played a violin almost as good as this fellow, Heifetz, or whatever his name is. Why, one time he sent me clear to New York to pick up a Stradivarius he'd heard about. And I had to hang around the dealer's store for 2 weeks before I got a chance to lift it. He wouldn't have trusted a job like that to any of the rest of the boys. He trusted me more than any of them. Me, Pascal. That's how come I feel so bad about what's happened. Because he trusted me. And he had to trust somebody, you understand. Because for 15 years, the boss had been stone blind.
Come on, Pascal. Eyes, man. Give me eyes.
But it's foggy down there, boss. I can't see the bay at all, just the end of the bridge. And out toward the Golden Gate, there's nothing but just fog. I guess it's going to rain.
What about the street below us, Pascal? What's going on down there?
Nothing. Just streetcars and taxis going up and down and a few people. Not very many. I tell you, boss, there's nothing doing at all. It's a very dull day.
All right, forget it. You can come away from the window.
Why don't you play the violin a while?
No, not today. I'm too restless. Something is going to happen, I think.
Happen? What's going to happen?
I don't know. Something. Are any of the boys here?
Brian and Daly in the next apartment playing gin rummy. You want I should call them?
No. I wonder if you know what it's like, Pascal, to live always in pitch darkness, depending on somebody else to tell you what's going on around you.
Ah, forget it, boss. You got me. I'm the eyes, you're the brain. We're doing all right.
Maybe, only sometimes I wonder...
I'll get it, boss. I'll get it. Mr. Heineman's apartment. Who? Well, I'm not sure whether Mr. Heineman...
Who is it?
Oh, I see. All right, thanks. That was the manager. Your brother's here from Phoenix.
Mark? He's downstairs?
Yeah. He's on his way up. The manager couldn't stop him. He says he looks like he's in pretty bad shape.
Ever see a desert rat that didn't?
No.
Well, so I'm to be honored by a visit from my sanctimonious brother.
I wonder what he wants.
Oh, money, as usual. $300 or $400 to finance another 6 months of prospecting, and he'll repay it by telling me what an evil man I am.
I wouldn't give it to him, boss.
Why not? As long as it keeps him over there on the Arizona desert for most of the year, I can stand one or two visits from him. We can hear the elevator stopping. Better open the door.
I still say you ought to crack down on him.
Open the door. Hello, Mark.
Help.
Come in.
Me.
Boss, he's hurt or something.
Help me.
What is it? Eyes, Pascal. Quick.
Hasn't shaved for 4 or 5 days. He's weak,
help
trembling.
Me.
Holding on to the doorframe with his right hand, holding his chest with the other hand. I think he's been shot, boss.
Yes. Shot.
Come here.
Help me.
Come inside.
Take it easy. Take it easy.
Here, come on. Come on. Over on the couch.
Okay. Come on. Here we are, boss.
Easy now. There. What happened, Mark?
I had to get here. I want you to have it. So he can't.
He's out of his head.
Get Brian and Daly over here. Brian knows a lot about gunshot wounds.
All right, boss.
You...
What happened, Mark? Who shot you?
Shot.
Connect me with 907.
Had to
come
get
on,
here.
Come on, hello, Brian.
All that glitters
boss,
is...
Come over here right
away. All that... Fools. Oh, fools. Treasures of kings and princes... Dying.
Mark, you've got to get hold of yourself.
Dying. Had to get here. You get it instead of him. Watch out for him.
Who, Mark?
Map. Old map and a new map.
He doesn't even make sense.
Quiet.
Look.
Eyes, Pascal, what's he doing?
He's raised up a little. He's pointing with his finger at the carpet about 4 feet away.
When you get there... Watch for it. When the man comes, follow him. Understand?
Sure, Mark. When the man comes, follow him.
Yes. When the man comes, follow him.
What's he mean?
I don't know.
Follow him.
What's up, boss? Pascal said you wanted me.
Come in, Brian. This is my brother. He's been shot. See what you can do for him.
Yeah. Let's have a look.
I've got to think. I've got to think. What could he possibly have stumbled into?
Yeah, this happened a couple of days ago, at least. Should have had a doctor right away.
He wanted to get here for some reason, but why?
His Daly, boss.
Hey, what's coming off in here? You're not cooking up something and leaving little Daly out of it. Ain't I in this, Mom?
Stop your barking, Daly, before I throw you a can of Strong Hot.
Don't get so smart now, Pascal. I got as much right to talk around here as you have.
I said shut up. The boss's brother is here. He's been shot. He's in bad shape.
Yeah, you're not kidding, Pascal. Matter of fact, he's about in as bad shape as he'll ever be. Boss, he's dead.
That was the start of the thing. When a doc came, he said Mark should have died 24 hours earlier. Said he stayed alive long enough to get to Frisco on sheer nerve, nothing else. Mr. Heineman, he don't say much. He let the doctor take charge of everything. There was a wallet and some other stuff in Mark's pockets. Mr. Heineman, he took it with him and went into his own room and stayed there. After a while, the other boys drifted back to their rummy game, and finally, about 10 o'clock, I went to bed. At 2 in the morning, I woke up to find Heineman shaking my arm.
Pascal, can you hear me? Pascal, come on, come on, wake up.
Okay, boss. I'm awake. What's the matter?
I've been thinking. Got some ideas I'd like to talk about.
All right, I'm listening.
It's about Mark, the things he said. They begin to make sense.
Well, maybe to you, but not to me.
Look, is this what I think it is?
Oh, wait a minute, boss. Let me give it some light.
Oh.
It's a map of a mountain range, I think. There's a lot of wavy lines like they use for valleys and ridges. There's some faded writing on it, brown ink. I think it's pretty old.
60 or 70 years at least, judging by the feel of the paper. Go on, Pascal. Describe it to me.
Well, what looks like a road runs across the bottom along the base of the mountains. And there's a spot on it marked Red Hill. And there's a wavy line starts there and runs about halfway up the map. It runs past some dots marked three trees. And off on one side is a little drawing of a shovel with a broken handle. And it ends at another spot marked camp.
It's probably a trail.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, the camp is beside a line that looks like the edge of a ridge or a cliff. And there's some writing that says, if no answer, go down.
If no answer, go down. What else?
Well, about a third of the way to the left from the camp, there's an X marked, and it says, man lives here.
Up toward the top, there's another X. That's marked Thunder Peak. And at the very top, there's the word superstition. I guess that's about all.
Good. Later, I'll have you take my finger and trace over the whole thing until I know it by heart. But this is enough to start on.
To start what on?
A search for whatever caused my brother's death. Something rather valuable, if my thinking is correct.
All right. Only, how do we go about finding it?
Mark told us how. When the man comes, follow him.
You know what it means?
Not yet.
Well, if the map's 60 years old or more, how do you figure this guy's going to be there?
Because my brother found him and followed him and then died for it. We're going to follow him, too. You and I and Bryant and Daly. We're going to Phoenix.
Boss, I think maybe it's the kind of mistake to take Daly along.
Why?
Well, because he's a double-crosser. That's why I've been trying to tell you. You can't trust him.
Don't worry. I can handle him. He's not the one who has to be watched.
Then who is? Bryant?
Let's leave it for now. Call the ticket office and get 4 reservations on the next plane out. I've got the feeling we'd better move fast.
By the next afternoon, we checked into the Hotel Westward Ho in Phoenix and started trying to get a line on Mark Heineman's recent activities. After 2 days, we still didn't have much to go on. He'd apparently hooked up with some new partner about 6 months before and gone into the desert. No one had seen anything of him since. An old man who ran a hardware store where Mark had bought tools and supplies finally gave us the tip-off without knowing it.
You see, Mr. Heineman, your brother was one of the fellows around here who believed in the legend of the Lost Dutchman mine. I figure that's what he was really prospecting for.
And what is the Lost Dutchman mine?
Well, it's supposed to be a deposit of gold, richer than any's ever been found. A real treasure of kings.
Treasure of kings? Boss, that's what he said.
Quiet, Pascal.
According to the stories, there's supposed to be a map in existence somewhere showing the exact location of the mine, drawn by the Dutchman himself. During the last 50 years or so, a lot of prospectors have gone back into the superstitions looking for it, but none of them...
What do you mean by superstitions?
Superstition Mountains, out on the desert east of town. That's where the mine's supposed to be located.
Why are they called superstitions?
Yes, because so many fellas have gone up into them and never come back. There's supposed to be an Apache curse on anybody goes in there. The range used to be sacred to the Indian god of thunder.
I see. And why do you think these men never came back?
Heat, thirst, got lost, snake bite. Oh, it's awful rough country, and there's no water. Then, too, there might be a kind of curse on the place at that. The double cross.
Meaning?
Well, blazing sun and a lust for gold can be a bad combination on a man's nerves. A lot of partners have come back out of those hills alone.
Double cross, huh? At least that's one curse that isn't limited to the superstitions. You'll find it in a lot of places. Well, we'd better go. Many thanks for your information.
Well, not at all, Mr. Heineman. Sorry, couldn't be more help.
So that's what Mark found, a gold mine.
A rich one, maybe?
It must be. Mark was dying and he knew it, and yet all he talked about was treasure of kings. Gold, in other words. He didn't even tell us who shot him.
Maybe his partner did it.
Maybe. Pascal.
Yeah?
I want you to buy a pair of binoculars and rent a car.
Uh-huh.
We're going to drive out and try to locate that red hill this afternoon.
All right, boss.
The one thing we've got to watch out for is that curse. That's what happened to Mark.
Yeah, it's only an Indian superstition.
I'm talking about the double cross. Mark wasn't the first man to die from it, and I don't think he'll be the last. Here, Pascal, let me take your arm.
I rented a Nash sedan from the garage at the hotel, and we headed out across the desert east of town. It was late afternoon before we finally found it. The only red hill on the east slope of the superstitions. Mr. Heineman told me to take the binoculars and try to locate the 3 trees that were marked on the map. I left the car, worked my way around the far side of the hill and almost to the top before I could see the trees standing close together on the shoulder of the ridge about 6 miles away. Just the way they were shown on Mark Heineman's map. I stared up at the pale blue peaks in the distance, watched the lightning flashes from near the tops of them and shivered a little. Finally, I turned and started back to the road. Dusk had fallen fast, like it does in the desert, and it was nearly dark when I reached the car and opened the door. Mr. Heineman was slumped over in the seat with blood running from a cut in his forehead. He was unconscious.
In
In just a moment, we will return to Escape. But first, Ozzie and Harriet are back on CBS, coming to you on most of these same stations every Sunday evening, just before the Jack Benny Show. You'll find them more delightful, more welcome than ever. Ozzie and Harriet's own two boys, Ricky and David, are now playing themselves in the CBS series. So make it a family party with Ozzie and Harriet tomorrow night. And now with our star, Paul Dubov, as Pascal, and with Herb Butterfield as Mr. Heinemann, we return to the second act of Escape and... When the Man Comes, Follow Him.
Boss. Boss, come on now, wake up. You're not hurt bad. Huh? It's only a little cut in your scalp. Come on. Come on, boss.
Come on. Pascal.
Yeah. It's me. I'm here with you now. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, Pascal. Did you see him?
No, I didn't see anybody. Who was it? What happened?
A man. Talked with a Texas draw, wearing heavy boots with hobnails.
Uh-huh.
Came up on the side of the car next to the hill and poked a gun in my face. He knew who I was and that I was blind. He wanted the map.
Did he get it?
No. I put it under the floor mat.
Good.
And I heard him coming.
Good.
Tried to grab his gun. He slugged me. Started going through my pockets.
Uh-huh.
Ran off in the rocks when he heard you coming.
Well, it's dark up there now. No good trying to follow him.
Oh, never mind. I know who he is.
Oh, did he tell you?
No, but it fits together. Mark had a partner.
This guy?
Sure. Who else could he be?
Then this is the guy who shot Mark.
I think so. I imagine there was a double cross and he got even, but... Wait. No, of course not.
What's the matter, boss?
Oh, what a fool I've been.
What do you mean?
I had it figured all along that Mark double-crossed his partner and got shot for it. It was the other way around.
Oh.
It was Mark's map. And this partner doesn't know the secret of it.
Uh-huh.
He probably knows where the man lives, but 10 to 1 he doesn't know about following him. Pascal.
Yeah, boss?
Get the car started and head back for the hotel. We've got to get an outfit together and start up that trail tomorrow morning. There's no time to lose. Let's go.
At 9 o'clock the next morning, the four of us passed the Red Hill and started up the rocky trail that led toward the far-off heights of Thunder Peak. Brian and Daly each led 2 mules loaded with food and kegs of water, and I took care of Mr. Heinemann. It was already hot, even at that time of morning, and boy, it got hotter. The line drawn on the map followed the crest of a ridge, but there wasn't really any trail. We wound around through tumbled masses of rocks and boulders, climbed over cliffs and gullies, and stumbled across crumbling slopes of debris that slid away beneath our feet and crashed down into the ravine. By noon, we were stopping to rest every 10 minutes. Even the rest didn't do no good, because there wasn't any shade. By late afternoon, we'd covered only 6 miles, and we were done in. None of us had known how hot a desert sun could get. We were ready to turn back or fight one another at the least excuse.
Yep! Yep!
Come on. Move, you four-legged devil. It's no worse for you than it is for me.
What's the matter, Daly? Your tongue's hanging out.
Yep. Let it hang. When I get yep. back to Frisco, I never want to see the sun again.
That's good for you.
Nuts.
It'll give you a tan. Get rid of that fish belly San Quentin complexion of yours.
How would you like to have a bullet in the stomach, Pascal?
Go ahead and draw if you feel lucky.
Pascal, Daly, that's enough now. Yeah. Cut it out.
Now, Pascal started.
I don't care who started. That's enough. We're too close to $1 million worth of gold to have the whole thing loused up because somebody lost his temper.
You said $1 million?
That's right, Brian. According to the story, that's how much the Dutchman is supposed to have dug out of the mine and hidden... before he was killed by Apaches without ever getting back to bring it out.
$1 million. Boy, what a man could do with $1 million.
Not $1 million, Daly. 25% of $1 million. That's the amount of your share, you know.
Yeah, sure. I know. I was just thinking.
Hey, look. Right ahead of us. We couldn't see him on account of the ridge.
Trees! 3 trees!
Oh, boy, a little shade will sure keep...
What's wrong? Eyes, Pascal, what is it?
The trees, boss, the ones marked on the map. Only they're dead, been dead for years, they look like.
Yeah.
There's not a square foot of shade under all 3 of them.
Well, can't be helped. At least it means we're on the right trail. Well, it's still the easiest way I know to get $1 million. Let's push on.
Two hours later, we came across a shovel with a broken handle stuck on the top of a pile of rocks, so we knew we were still heading in the right direction. The shovel had been drawn on the map. We stopped there for the night. A while after dark, the boss heard somebody in the rocks, so we put out the fire we'd built and took turns standing guard.
And later when the moon was up, I thought I saw something moving a short way off, but I couldn't be sure. Yeah, it was a creepy feeling, thinking I was being watched, not seeing anybody. All night long, I could see the flares of lightning and hear the low thunder from the top of the shadowy peak ahead of us. Was I glad when dawn finally came and we hit that trail again. But 2 hours later, I was wishing for sundown again. It was even hotter than the day before. And on top of it, all of us were so stiff and sore we could hardly move. We cursed and sweated and stumbled through the long, blazing day. Finally, at dusk, we reached the spot marked camp on the map. It was close to the edge of a straight-walled cliff that yawned over a deep-box canyon below. There were signs of campfires and burrow tracks. This place had been used before. Yeah, we were too tired to care. Not even bothering to unsaddle the mules, we drank from one of the kegs and dropped down in the shade of a rock ledge, not able to move any further. After about an hour, the sun slipped behind the ridges to the west and left us in the shadow. The boss got us onto our feet, put Brian to search for something to use for a fire, and told Daly to unpack the mules. He took me with him to scout along the rim of the cliff and try to find out what was meant by the words on the map. If no answer, go down. After half an hour, we found nothing. And we were ready to decide there was no way to go down that 1,000-foot rock wall when suddenly...
Pascal, that was a shot. You see anything?
No, it was back toward camp, but there's a ridge between us. I can't see a sign of any...
Come on, Pascal.
Yeah.
Take hold of my arm.
Okay.
Let's get back there fast.
Who is it? Come on, speak up or I'll shoot.
Relax, Brian. It's us.
That's Pascal and the boss. Did you see anybody?
No. What happened?
Somebody took a shot at Daly. He got all spooked up and fired off half a clip.
It was that guy that's been following us, boss. I saw him there in the rocks not more than 100 feet away.
And you missed him, I suppose.
Well, it was dark.
Hey, what happened to the mules? They're gone.
Yeah, they stampeded when Daly fired off that gun in their ears.
That's great. We'll have a fine time packing 5 kegs of water and all the supplies on our backs.
Yeah, well...
Boss, we don't have 5 kegs of water. There's only one here.
One!
I hadn't unpacked the mules yet, boss. I was going as soon as it got a little cooler.
You fool. You stupid, lazy, blundering fool.
That's what I've been telling you, boss. All the brains this dope's got...
You shut up, Pascal. One more crack. It's
enough. Help me. Daly, I could kill you and love it. I could stand here and pump bullets into you and love it. Do you know how long a man can live up here without water? 24 hours at the most.
But we still got 5 gallons of water. I didn't know they were going to run off. How could I...
Shut up. It's done. That's that. Go see if there's any chance of finding them. And try to keep from getting yourself shot. Better go with him, Brian.
Okay, boss. Come on, smart boy.
If you don't find them in 20 minutes, come on back. 5 gallons of water for 4 men. It'll take us a full day to get down into that canyon and find the spot where the man lives. And another day to get back here, if we're lucky. Then 2 more days back to the road. I guess we can just barely make it.
There's only one thing, boss. There's no way to get down into that canyon.
I think I've got the answer there. At least that's one thing that shooting did. Listen. Hello! Hello!
Sure. It's an echo.
If no answer, go down.
Yeah.
I think we'll find a spot someplace along the rim of that cliff where there's no echo. When we do, I think there'll be some way to get down to the bottom. We'll try it in the morning. And one other thing, Pascal, before they come back.
Yeah, boss?
From here on, keep an eye on Bryant. I think that gold is beginning to look pretty big to him.
I think maybe you're making a mistake. I think Daly's a lot more likely to try something. He's a born double-crosser.
No.
This...
He's a fool and a coward. But Bryant's the one who's dangerous. And you do as I tell you. And watch out for him. Do you understand?
All right. Sure, boss. Whatever you say. An hour after dawn the next morning, we found a spot on the edge of the cliffs where there was no echo. Slanting downward from it was a narrow, steep crack in the wall. The 4 of us took turns packing our 1 last keg of water and inched our way down toward the canyon floor 1,000 feet below. We made it finally, rested, then struck out to the west following the map. Great chunks of rock lay tossed about it, though giants had played there, and thorn and cactus grew everywhere among them.
The sunlight curled and blistered on the surface of the boulders, and always from above us and nearer now came the sullen and ominous roll of thunder. At noon, we stumbled across the bed of the ravine, nearly missing it from being half-blinded by the heat. And 3 hours later, we found the place where the man lives. It was marked by a monument built of broken rock stacked up higher than our heads. Mr. Heineman felt all over the surface of it with his hands and then told us he knew the meaning of the words, "When the man comes, follow him." But he said it wasn't time yet. We'd have to wait. We sat there by the pile of stones, not talking much. Just waiting. 2 hours passed. I think it was Daly who noticed it first.
Look. Look there on the ground.
There's somebody here. He's behind us.
Hit the dirt!
I don't see any. So that's it.
Boys, I'm a little disappointed in you. Scared by a shadow.
Oh, well,
look at it. It's a shadow of that pile of rocks. Looks just like a man with a hat on holding a gun.
Yeah. The rock pile don't look like a man, but the shadow does.
Well, since he's apparently come now, I guess we'd better follow him.
Huh?
How do you mean follow him?
The sun's going down. The shadow must be getting longer, stretching out over the ground. So get going. Follow the direction it's pointing.
All yeah. Right,
Pascal will stay here with me and keep you on line. Right. Watch for signs of something buried. Rocks laid over it, a cleared space, something of that kind.
Okay.
We're not more than a few feet from $1,000,000. Let's get it.
Two of them worked their way along through the rocks while I stood by the monument and waved them toward one side or the other. Part of the time, they were out of sight behind a ledge of boulder. An army could have hidden in that broken mess and never been noticed. I kept describing everything that was happening to the boss. And about 20 minutes went by before I heard Daly shout,
"We found it! Gold! It's here! We found it!"
He scrambled over a ledge and came running toward us, calling out and holding something in his hand. Then about 100 feet away from us, he stopped suddenly and drew his gun.
Pascal, what is it? What's happening?
Daly's pulled a gun on his boss. Drop it, Daly! Drop it or I'll shoot!
No, Pascal! He's in between us, you fool! He's hiding in the rocks!
All right, Daly, you asked for it!
Pascal, no!
I got him, boss! The dirty double-crosser!
You fool!
He was going to kill us, boss. He was coming at us with a... Wait, somebody staggered out of the rocks there and fell. Somebody I never saw before.
My brother's partner, the man who's been following us.
But then Daly killed him and I killed Daly. Boss, I thought Daly was shooting at us. I didn't know there was anybody else there.
Well, you know now. I told you to keep an eye on Bryant. What's happened to him? Pascal, where's Bryant?
Right behind you, sucker.
Look out, boss! How's he shooting, Bryant? I got him, boss. He missed me and I got him.
Good. Only he didn't miss me.
Boss! No, 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 boss.
Pascal, can you hear the thunder?
Yeah, sure. It's real loud.
It's funny. Same old curse. Double cross.
My fault, boss. I should have done like you told me and watched Bryant.
$1,000,000 in gold for somebody else.
Don't talk like that. It's for us. For us, for you and me. I'll get you out, boss. You're not really hit bad, you know?
Bad? I'm dying. And you too, Pascal.
What?
You're gonna die too.
What? What do you mean?
The water keg. Bryant's bullet smashed it. I heard the water running out.
Huh? No. No. No.
Am I right?
Yeah. So... gone.
It's 3 days out to the highway, Pascal. And you don't have any water. You poor devil. You don't have one single drop of water.
Escape is produced and directed by Norman MacDonald. Today we have presented transcribed When the Man Comes, Follow Him by Ralph Bates, adapted for radio by Les Crutchfield, with editorial supervision by John Dunkel. Starred as Pascal was Paul Dubov, with Herb Butterfield as Mr. Heineman. Featured in the cast were Harry Bartell, Jeff Corey, Barney Phillips, and Junius Matthews. Special music was arranged and played by Ivan Dittmars. It's wonderful, truly amazing, how much you can get from just one radio program. The unbounded passion of the world's greatest Don Juan, the unrivaled music of the world's most eminent soloist, an unsurpassed lesson in philanthropy. Also, some of the greatest laughter you'll ever hear. For the program is The Jack Benny Show. Be sure to hear Jack Benny and his gang again Sunday at 7 o'clock Eastern Time over these same CBS stations. This is Roy Rowan speaking.
I know. Another break. What can I do? It's a promise to come back soon.
Strange Adventure. Seated around a table in the lounge car of the Starlight Limited, three men thoroughly enjoyed such talk as passed between men of the world. Allison Muir, the motion picture producer, then continued.
Now, as I was saying, Lynn Lane is a cute enough kid, but she's no actress. Sure, I picked her up in a Kansas farm and took her to Hollywood, yeah. Now she's stuck and won't go back home. Keeps begging me for parts.
Jonathan Hawk of the Homicide Bureau turned to the impeccably dressed movie mogul.
You seem to do very well with your collections, Mr. Muir. I understand you also make a hobby of antique knives.
Yes, that's right, Mr. Hawk. I'd like to show them to you. Conductor, hand me that leather case there, will you?
The conductor, the third man of the party, reached across the aisle for a small case and laid it upon the table. Muir opened it, displaying a unique collection of bladed weapons. He lifted each from its place and showed it to the two men. After a while, the conversation lulled. Muir stifled a yawn.
Gentlemen, please excuse me. I'll see if I can get some sleep. I'll see you in the morning.
The conductor rose and looked at his watch.
Well, I guess I'd better take off, too. Time to make my rounds.
Inspector Hawk picked up a magazine and nodded to the two disappearing men. The police officer was starting the second chapter of his mystery thriller when a very frightened porter rushed into the lounge car.
There's been a man killed in his bunk. He's been murdered, sir.
Allison Muir had been stabbed to death. The conductor stepped to the side of the officer.
I was on my way through the train when I noticed Muir's hand dangling from his bunk.
Jonathan Hawk noted the clean-cut wound in the man's chest.
Conductor, search the passengers, the crew in the car for the murder weapon.
The conductor busily searched the bewildered group of passengers and members of the train crew. He finished at last and turned to the inspector.
Well, I've searched everybody, but I can't find anything. I see. You say you searched everybody yourself? That's right, Inspector. Just like you told me to.
Thank you. Now I must ask you to allow me to search you. And if I am right in my calculations, I'm going to hold you for murder.
The police inspector was right in his calculations. In one of the conductor's pockets, he found a long-bladed clasp knife. Hawk confronted the trainman.
You see, conductor, you said you would search the people and the car, but you hadn't had anyone search you. Besides being new to the art of murder, your nervousness and actions helped to give you away.
The prisoner looked down at the floor of the swaying railway car, his face a blank mask.
Yes, Inspector, I killed him. He was right in what he said a while ago in the lounge car. He took a sweet girl from her home, and he made promises that he never kept. I swore that someday I'd repay his cruelty and deceit. Well, you see, Inspector, Lynn Lane is my granddaughter.
This is Pat McGinn in Hollywood, California, saying goodbye from my writer Charles Crowder and inviting you to listen again to another tale of
Strange Adventure.
Next is a reading of Jack London's That Dead Men Shall Rise Up Never from the LibriVox. Most of Jack London's books and stories, like most books and stories, are at their best when they're taken from real life. Jack London was born in 1876. His father, who never bothered to marry his mother, deserted her and him before the boy's birth, and would never acknowledge Jack as his son. When Jack was 8 months old, his mother married a poor migrant worker who was an uneducated and semi-skilled carpenter named John. Having been raised poor and growing into poverty, Jack went to work really very young. This story, That Dead Men Rise Up Never, developed out of Jack's experiences as a 17-year-old seaman during one of his trips into the South Pacific. And it's not the sort of thing that we normally do on this show, being more Scooby-Doo than Frankenstein's monster. It was originally published in Jack London's book of short stories, The Human Drift, in 1917.
That Dead Men Rise Up Never, by Jack London. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Doralene Kaplan. The month in which my 17th birthday arrived, I signed on before the mast on the Sophie Sutherland, a 3-topmast schooner bound on a 7-month seal hunting cruise to the coast of Japan. We sailed from San Francisco, and immediately I found confronting me a problem of no inconsiderable proportions. There were 12 men of us in the forecastle, 10 of whom were hardened, tarry-thumbed sailors. Not alone was I a youth and on my first voyage, but I had for shipmates men who had come through the hard school of the merchant service of Europe. As boys, they had to perform their ship's duty, and in addition, by immemorial sea custom, they had to be the slaves of the ordinary and able-bodied seamen. When they became ordinary seamen, they were still the slaves of the able-bodied. Thus, in the forecastle with the watch below, an able seaman lying in his bunk will order an ordinary seaman to fetch him his shoes or bring him a drink of water. Now the ordinary seaman may be lying in his bunk. He is just as tired as the able seaman, yet he must get out of his bunk and fetch and carry. If he refuses, he will be beaten. If perchance he is so strong that he can whip the able seaman, then all the able seamen, or as many as may be necessary, pitch upon the luckless devil and administer the beating. My problem now becomes apparent. These hard-bit Scandinavian sailors had come through a hard school. As boys, they had served their mates, and as able seamen, they looked to be served by other boys. I was a boy withal with a man's body. I had never been to sea before. Withal, I was a good sailor and knew my business. It was either a case of holding my own with them or of going under. I had signed on as an equal, and an equal I must remain myself or else endure 7 months of hell at their hands. And it was this very equality they resented. By what right was I an equal? I had not earned that high privilege. I had not endured the miseries they had endured as maltreated boys or bullied ordinaries. Worse than that, I was a landlubber making his first voyage, and yet, by the injustice of fate, on the ship's articles, I was their equal. My method was deliberate and simple and drastic. In the first place, I resolved to do my work, no matter how hard or dangerous it might be, so well that no man would be called upon to do it for me. Further, I put ginger in my muscles. I never malingered when pulling on a rope, for I knew the eagle eyes of my forecastle mates were squinting for just such evidences of my inferiority. I made it a point to be among the first of the watch going on deck, among the last going below, never leaving a sheet or tackle for someone else to coil over a pin. I was always eager for the run aloft, for the shifting of topsail sheets and tacks, or for the setting or taking in of topsails, and in these matters I did more than my share. Furthermore, I was on a hair-trigger of resentment myself. I knew better than any to accept any abuse or the slightest patronizing. At the first hint of such, I went off. I exploded. I might be beaten in the subsequent fight, but I left the impression that I was a wildcat and that I would just as willingly fight again. My intention was to demonstrate that I would tolerate no imposition. I proved that the man who imposed on me must have a fight on his hands, and doing my work well, the innate justice of the men, assisted by their wholesome dislike for a clawing and rending wildcat ruction, soon led them to give over their hectoring. After a bit of strife, my attitude was accepted, and it was my pride that I was taken in as an equal in spirit as well as in fact. From then on, everything was beautiful, and the voyage promised to be a happy one. But there was one other man in the forecastle. Counting the Scandinavians as 10 and myself as the 11th, This man was the 12th and last. We never knew his name, contenting ourselves with calling him the bricklayer. He was from Missouri, at least he so informed us in the one meager confidence he was guilty of in the early days of the voyage. Also, at that time, we learned several other things. He was a bricklayer by trade. He had never even seen salt water until the week before he joined us, at which time he'd arrived in San Francisco and looked upon San Francisco Bay. Why, he, of all men, at 40 years of age, should have felt the prod to go to sea was beyond all of us, for it was our unanimous conviction that no man less fitted for the sea had ever embarked in it. But to sea he had come. After a week's stay in a sailor's boarding house, he had been shoved aboard of us as an able seaman. All hands had to do his work for him. Not only did he know nothing, but he proved himself unable to learn anything. Try as they would, they could never teach him to steer. To him, the compass must have been a profound and awful whirligig. He never mastered its cardinal points, much less the checking and steadying of the ship on her course. He never did come to know whether ropes should be coiled from left to right or from right to left. It was mentally impossible for him to learn the easy muscular trick of throwing his weight on a rope in pulling and hauling. The simplest knots and turns were beyond his comprehension, while he was mortally afraid of going aloft. Bullied by captain and mate, he was one day forced aloft. He managed to get underneath the crosstrees, and there he froze to the ratlines. Two sailors had to go after him to help him down, all of which was bad enough had there been no worse. But he was vicious, malignant, dirty, and without common decency. He was a tall, powerful man, and he fought with everybody, and there was no fairness in his fighting. His first fight on board, the first day out, was with me, when he, desiring to cut a plug of chewing tobacco, took my personal table knife for the purpose, and whereupon I, on a hair trigger, promptly exploded. After that, he fought with nearly every member of the crew. When his clothing became too filthy to be bearable by the rest of us, we put it to soak and stood over him while he washed it. In short, the bricklayer was one of those horrible and monstrous things that one must see in order to be convinced that they exist. I will only say that he was a beast, and that we treated him like a beast. It is only by looking back through the years that I realize how heartless we were to him. He was without sin. He could not, by the very nature of things, have been anything else than he was. He had not made himself, and for his making he was not responsible. If we treated him as a free agent and held him personally responsible for all that he was and that he should not have been, as a result, our treatment of him was as terrible as he was himself terrible. Finally, we gave him the silent treatment, and for weeks before he died, we neither spoke to him nor did he speak to us. And for weeks he moved among us, or lay in his bunk in our crowded house, grinning at us his hatred and malignancy. He was a dying man, and he knew it, and we knew it. And furthermore, he knew that we wanted him to die. He cumbered our life with his presence, and ours was a rough life that made rough men of us. And so he died, in a small space crowded by 12 men, and as much alone as if he had died on some desolate mountain peak. No kindly word, no last word was passed between. He died as he had lived, a beast, and he died hating us and hated by us. And now I come to the most startling moment of my life. No sooner was he dead than he was flung overboard. He died in a night of wind, drawing his last breath as the men tumbled into their oilskins to the cry of "All hands!" And he was flung overboard several hours later on a day of wind. Not even a canvas wrapping graced his mortal remains, nor was he deemed worthy of bars of iron at his feet. We sewed him up in the blankets in which he died, and laid him on a hatch cover forward of the main hatch on the port side. A gunny sack, half full of galley coal, was fastened to his feet. It was bitter cold. The weather side of every rope, spar, and stay was coated with ice, while all the rigging was a harp, singing and shouting under the fierce hand of the wind. The schooner hove to, lurched and floundered through the sea, rolling her scuppers under and perpetually flooding the deck with icy, salt water. We of the forecastle stood in sea boots and oilskins. Our hands were mittened, but our heads were bared in the presence of the death we did not respect. Our ears stung and numbed and whitened, and we yearned for the body to be gone. But the interminable reading of the burial service went on. The captain had mistaken his place, and while he read on without purpose, we froze our ears and resented this final hardship thrust upon us by the helpless cadaver. As from the beginning, so to the end, everything had gone wrong with the bricklayer. Finally, the captain's son, irritated beyond measure, jerked the book from the palsied fingers of the old man and found the place. Again the quavering voice of the captain arose. Then came the cue. "And the body shall be cast into the sea." We elevated one end of the hatch cover, and the bricklayer plunged outboard and was gone. Back into the forecastle we cleaned house, washing out the dead man's bunk and removing every vestige of him. By sea law and sea custom, we should have gathered his effects together and turned them over to the captain, who later would have held an auction in which we should have bid for the various articles. But no man wanted them. So we tossed them up on deck and overboard in the wake of the departed body, the last ill treatment we could devise to wreak upon the one we had hated so. Oh, it was raw, believe me, but the life we lived was raw, and we were as raw as the life. The bricklayer's bunk was better than mine, less seawater leaked down through the deck into it, and the light was better for lying in bed and reading. Partly for this reason, I proceeded to move into his bunk. My other reason was pride. I saw the sailors were superstitious, and by this act I determined to show that I was braver than they. I would cap my proved equality by a deed that would compel their recognition of my superiority. Oh, the arrogance of youth! But let that pass. The sailors were appalled by my intention. One and all, they warned me that in the history of the sea, no man had taken a dead man's bunk and lived to the end of the voyage. They instanced case after case in their personal experience. I was obdurate. Then they begged and pleaded with me, and my pride was tickled in that they showed they really liked me and were concerned about me. This but served to confirm me in my madness. I moved in, and lying in the dead man's bunk all afternoon and evening, listened to dire prophecies of my future. Also were told stories of awful deaths and gruesome ghosts that secretly shivered the hearts of all of us. Saturated with this, yet scoffing at it, I rolled over at the end of the second dog watch and went to sleep. At 11:50, I was called, and at 12 I was dressed and on deck, relieving the man who had called me. On the sealing grounds, when hove to, a watch of only a single man is kept through the night, each man holding the deck for an hour. It was a dark night, though not a black one. The gale was breaking up and the clouds were thinning. There should have been a moon. And though invisible in some way, a dim, suffused radiance came from it. I paced back and forth across the deck amidships. My mind was filled with the event of the day and with the horrible tales my shipmates had told. And yet I dare to say here and now that I was not afraid. I was a healthy animal, and furthermore, intellectually, I agreed with Swinburne that dead men rise up never. The bricklayer was dead, and that was the end of it. He would rise up never, at least never on the deck of the Sophie Sutherland. Even then, he was in the ocean depths, miles to windward of our leeward drift, and the likelihood was that he was already portioned out in the maws of many sharks. Still, my mind pondered on the tales of the ghosts of dead men I had heard, and I speculated on the spirit world. My conclusion was that if the spirits of the dead still roam the world, they carry the goodness or the malignancy of the earth life with them. Therefore, granting the hypothesis, which I didn't grant at all, the ghost of the bricklayer was bound to be as hateful and malignant as he in life had been. But there wasn't any bricklayer's ghost. That I insisted upon. A few minutes thinking thus, I paced up and down. Then, glancing casually forward along the port side, I leaped like a startled deer and in a blind madness of terror rushed aft along the poop, heading for the cabin. Gone was all my arrogance of youth and my intellectual calm. I had seen a ghost. There, in the dim light, where we had flung the dead man overboard, I had seen a faint and wavering form. 6 feet in length it was, slender, and of substance so attenuated that I had distinctly seen through it the tracery of the fore rigging. As for me, I was as panic-stricken as a frightened horse. I had ceased to exist. Through me were vibrating the fiber instincts of 10,000 generations of superstitious forebears who had been afraid of the dark and the things of the dark. I was not. I was, in truth, those 10,000 forebears. I was the race, the whole human race, in its superstitious infancy. Not until part way down the cabin companionway did my identity return to me. I checked my flight and clung to the steep ladder, suffocating, trembling, and dizzy. Never before nor since have I had such a shock. I clung to the ladder and considered. I could not doubt my senses. That I had seen something, there was no discussion. But what was it? Either a ghost or a joke. There could be nothing else. If a ghost, the question was, would it appear again? If it did not, and I aroused the ship's officers, I would make myself the laughing stock of all on board. And by the same token, if it were a joke, my position would be still more ridiculous. If I were to retain my hard-won place of equality, it would never do to arouse anyone until I ascertained the nature of the thing. I'm a brave man, I dare to say so, for in fear and trembling, I crept up the companionway and went back to the spot from which I had first seen the thing. It had vanished. My bravery was qualified, however. Though I could see nothing, I was afraid to go forward to the spot where I had seen the thing. I resumed my pacing up and down, and though I cast many an anxious glance toward the dread spot, nothing manifested itself. As my equanimity returned to me, I concluded that the whole affair had been a trick of the imagination and that I had got what I deserved for allowing my mind to dwell on such matters. Once more my glances forward were casual and not anxious, and then suddenly I was a madman rushing wildly aft. I had seen the thing again, the long, wavering, attenuated substance through which could be seen the fore rigging. This time I had reached only the break of the poop when I checked myself. Again, I reasoned over the situation, and it was pride that counseled strongest. I could not afford to make myself a laughing stock. This thing, whatever it was, I must face alone. I must work it out myself. I looked back to the spot where we had tilted the bricklayer. It was vacant. Nothing moved, and for a third time I resumed my amidships pacing. In the absence of the thing, my fear died away, and my intellectual poise returned. Of course it was not a ghost. Dead men did not rise up. It was a joke, a cruel joke. My mates of the forecastle, by some unknown means, were frightening me. Twice already they must have seen me run aft. My cheeks burned with shame. In fancy, I could hear the smothered chuckling and laughter, even then going on in the forecastle. I began to grow angry. Jokes were all very well, but this was carrying the thing too far. I was the youngest on board, only a youth, and they had no right to play tricks on me of the order that I well knew in the past had made raving maniacs of men and women. I grew angrier and angrier, and resolved to show them that I was made of sterner stuff, and at the same time to wreak my resentment upon them. If the thing appeared again, I made my mind up that I would go up to it. Furthermore, that I would go up to it knife in hand. When within striking distance, I would strike. If a man, he would get the knife thrust he deserved. If a ghost, well, it wouldn't hurt the ghost any. Well, I would have learned that dead men did rise up. Now, I was very angry, and I was quite sure the thing was a trick. But when the thing appeared a third time in the same spot, long, attenuated, and wavering, fear surged up in me and drove most of my anger away. But I did not run, nor did I take my eyes from the thing. Both times before, it had vanished while I was running away, so I had not seen the manner of its going. I drew my sheath knife from my belt and began my advance, step by step, nearer and nearer. The effort to control myself grew more severe. The struggle was between my will, my identity, my very self on the one hand, and on the other, the 10,000 ancestors who were twisted into the fibers of me and whose ghostly voices were whispering of the dark and the fear of the dark that had been theirs in the time when the world was dark and full of terror. I advanced more slowly, and still the thing wavered and flittered with strange, eerie lurches. And then, right before my eyes, it vanished. I saw it vanished. Neither to the right nor left did it go, nor backward. Right there, while I gazed upon it, it faded away, ceased to be. I didn't die, but I swear from what I experienced in those few succeeding moments, I know full well that men can die of fright. I stood there, knife in hand, swaying automatically to the roll of the ship, paralyzed with fear. Had the bricklayer suddenly seized my throat with corporeal fingers and proceeded to throttle me, it would have been no more than I expected. Dead men did rise up, and that would be the most likely thing the malignant bricklayer could do. But he didn't seize my throat. Nothing happened. And since nature abhors the status, I could not remain there in the one place forever paralyzed. I turned and started aft. I did not run. What was the use? What chance had I against the malevolent world of ghosts? Flight with me was the swiftness of my legs. The pursuit with a ghost was the swiftness of thought. And there were ghosts. I had seen one. And so, stumbling slowly aft, I discovered the explanation of the seeming. I saw the mizzen topmast lurching across a faint radiance of cloud, behind which was the moon. The idea leaped in my brain. I extended the line between the cloudy radiance and the mizzen topmast and found that it must strike somewhere near the fore rigging on the port side. Even as I did this, the radiance vanished. The driving clouds of the breaking gale were alternately thickening and thinning before the face of the moon, but never exposing the face of the moon. And when the clouds were at their thinnest, it was a very dim radiance that the moon was able to make. I watched and waited. The next time the clouds thinned, I looked forward, and there was the shadow of the topmast, long and attenuated, wavering and lurching on the deck and against the rigging. This was my first ghost. Once again have I seen a ghost. It proved to be a Newfoundland dog, and I don't know which of us was the more frightened, for I hit that Newfoundland a full right-arm swing to the jaw. Regarding the bricklayer's ghost, I will say that I never mentioned it to a soul on board. Also, I will say that in all my life, I never went through more torment and mental suffering than on that lonely night watch on the Sophie Sutherland. That Dead Men Rise Up Never by Jack London.
Well, we're going to take a bit of a break right now, but we'll be back very soon with X minus one. In the science fiction community, the term dean of science fiction has been thrown around rather loosely, applied to everybody from Jack Williamson to Olaf Stapledon to Elsfred de Camp, Harry Harrison. But really, there's only one dean of science fiction, and his name was Robert Anson Heinlein. Off the top of my head, I'm not sure how long Robert Heinlein's been dead. I think he died in about 1981. But while he lived, there was no more seminal writer of science fiction. His influence is everywhere. He wrote a number of just excellent juveniles. I cut my teeth on books like Tunnel in the Sky, Citizen of the Galaxy, and a host of others. I went straight into his books like Double Star, The Puppet Masters, Waldo Incorporated, and he matured with the field, writing in the 1960s, I think about 1963, the incredibly influential story of Michael Valentine Smith, a boy who was raised on Mars by Martians, for a book called Stranger in a Strange Land, which was adopted, maybe to Bob Heinlein's chagrin, by the youth movement. Bob Heinlein was always a bit of a controversial writer. I think today you would have to call him a libertarian. His influence extended into movies. The George Powell film, Destination Moon, was based on a Heinlein story. And I guess you kind of have to blame Heinlein for some of its deficiencies. Because Heinlein was there, day by day, on the set, making sure that everything was accurate. Technically and scientifically, for the time, it was an excellent film. But, as Jerry Pornelli pointed out recently, it is kind of dull, folks. What follows is an adaptation for X-1 of Bob Heinlein's 1940s short story, The Roads Must Roll. It aired on January the 4th of 1956. And truthfully, I have to say that I personally find it a bit of a disappointment.
Countdown for blast-off. X-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X-minus 1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on 1,000 maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Street & Smith, publishers of astounding science fiction, presents
X-1.
Tonight's story, The Roads Must Roll by Robert Heinlein. It was in the middle 1950s that the automotive age began to die. The traffic engineers had long expected it. For years, they had watched our vast cities sprawl and spread out, spill over into the countryside, become more and more dependent on motor transportation. And then finally, the inevitable breaking point was reached. The growing flood of cars and buses and trucks began to swamp the streets and arterial highways. The building of roads could no longer keep pace. The superhighways clogged, congested, became packed with cars stalled bumper to bumper. And the cities began to die of slow strangulation, for the traffic could no longer roll. And then the engineers took over. They banned the automobiles, tore up the superhighways, and in their place they built the rolling roads. Mechanized roads that moved like huge conveyor belts, whirling along on their giant rotors at speeds ranging from 5 to 100 miles an hour, carrying the freight, the food, and the people from city to city and coast to coast. And no one worried over the fact that if the road should ever stop, our whole economic life would stop. For the machinery had never failed yet. But people forgot that machinery depends on men, the men who run it.
Who makes the roads roll?
We do! We do!
That's right, the engineers. We're the brains of the road. And where would the public be if we didn't keep the roads rolling? Right behind the eight ball, and everybody knows it. All right, then. We're the men who hold the power, and it's time we started using it. We've called this meeting of the Engineers Control Committee because that's what we want to do. Control. Because I'm tired of taking orders from the Transport Commission, from slick desk jockeys like Jim Gaines, who don't even know a rotor bearing from a field call. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Now, let Gaines yammer about our duty to the public. That's a lot of eyewash. We've got the power, and we're the men that count. Now, it's time we quit fiddling around and use a little direct action to get what we want.
Mr. Chairman!
The chair recognizes Brother Harvey of the Transport Mechanics Union.
Thanks. Now, I don't rightly belong here since I'm no engineer. I'm just here to represent the workers' union. But I want to know what's all the shouting for. You engineers have got better working conditions than we have, and we ain't kicking. You say the engineers are powerful. You say you can tie up the roads. Well, so can any screwball with a jar of nitroglycerin. And he wouldn't need no engineer's degree to do it, neither.
Harvey, are you speaking for your union now, or are you here as a stooge for the Transport Commission?
Listen, Van Cleek, I helped found my union. I led the strike in 75 for decent working conditions. Where were you engineers then? With the Fink!
Brother Harvey, remember, you're only a guest at this meeting. Go on, Van.
Now listen, man. I'm one of the old engineers on the roads. You all are. Worked up the hard way. We didn't go to the fancy technical institutes like those young punk cadet engineers the commission is training to take over our jobs unless we do something to stop them. Jim Gaines hasn't been able to fill us full of the old school spirit and that baloney about how the roads must roll. So all right then. Why don't we get smart for a change? What would happen if the roads stopped rolling? Maybe the country would begin to realize that they can't do it without us. Maybe we'd begin to get the things we want. Who says the roads must roll?
Yes?
Your wife is calling, Mr. Gaines.
Put her on.
Jim, I want you to stop off on your way home.
I'm sorry, darling. I can't make it.
But you promised.
I know, but Washington called in. They're sending Evans, the Australian Minister of Transport, through my sector today. I've got to show him through personally.
Can't somebody else?
I'm chief supervisor. Wouldn't be courteous.
Courtesy begins at home. I've planned this dinner for weeks.
Honey, the roads must roll.
Oh, if you quote that nauseating slogan at me again, I'll divorce you.
I can't help it, darling. I'll meet you at Stockton at 9 and we'll take in a show. Kiss Alan goodnight for me.
All right, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Mr. Evans is here.
Show him in. Well, good evening, Mr. Evans. I'm Gaines, chief engineer.
How do you do, Mr. Gaines? They told me at the embassy you'd be the man to see. I want to know how the roads work.
I think we can handle that.
Well, I'm not a technical man, Mr. Gaines. My field is sociology. So, suppose you tell me about the roads as if I were entirely ignorant.
Fine. It's nearly at dinner time. Suppose we run up to Stockton Sector for dinner. It'll take us about an hour on the roads, and you can see them working.
Excellent.
If you'll excuse me a minute.
Certainly.
Hi, Chief. What can I do for you?
Dave, you're on evening watch, eh?
Uh-huh.
Where's Van Cleek?
Going to some meeting.
I'm going up to Stockton for dinner. Anything to report?
No, sir. The roads are rolling.
Okay. Keep them rolling. All right, Mr. Evans. Let's go. This is the low-speed strip. Ever ridden a conveyor before?
No.
It's quite simple. Remember to face the motion of the strip as you get on. There. You go right across. Each adjoining strip is a few miles an hour faster than the one next to it. Freight is carried on the 50-mile strip, most passenger traffic on the express strip. All right, now watch your step. Here we are. The maximum speed.
100 miles an hour. It doesn't seem possible.
This trip makes the round trip San Diego to Reno in 12 hours. Ready to eat?
Is this the restaurant?
Jake's Steakhouse. Fastest meal on the road.
Is it really a proper restaurant?
One of the best. Shall we go in?
Hello, Mr. Gaines. We don't see you much out on the road.
Busy in the office, Jake.
Two? Right this way. What'll it be?
You order.
Well, how about a steak? 2 inches thick from a steer that died happy.
Fine. Plug me in the phone, will you?
There's one right next to you. Flank two, rare.
You'll excuse me, Mr. Evans?
Certainly.
Davidson on watch.
This is the chief. I'm at Jake's Steakhouse. You can reach me at 10L66.
10L66, right.
Yeah. Now they can get hold of me in an emergency.
Oh? What kind of emergency could there be?
Two, principally. Power failure on the rotors would bring the road to a standstill. If that happened during rush hour, we'd have to evacuate millions of people from the road.
As many as that?
Easily. There are 12 million people dependent on this section of road. Gaines here.
Hello, Chief Davidson. Just got the hourly reports in. Diego Circle, Bakerfield Sector, Stockton Sector, and Reno Circle all rolling.
Oh, you didn't have to bother me with the hourlies, Dave.
There's a supplementary from Sacramento.
Proceed.
Cadet Engineer Gunther, while on watch, was found playing cards with C.J. Ross, technician on duty.
Any damage?
One rotor running hot, but still synchronized. It was jacked down and replaced.
All right, have the paymaster give Ross his time and turn him over to civil authorities. Place Cadet Gunther under arrest and bring him to Rotown Central.
Yes, sir.
All right, keep him rolling. I was saying there were two possibilities of danger. Can you visualize what would happen if the strip under us would break?
Oh, I hadn't thought of that. You don't realize you're traveling at 100 miles an hour.
Well, it can't. Not now. The strip has a safety factor of over 12 to 1. It'd take a blowout of several miles of rotors and a failure of circuit breakers before the strip could part. But it happened once in the early days on the Philadelphia-Jersey City road. The strip wasn't much more than a conveyor belt. It buckled for miles, crushing passengers against the roof. Forward section in front of the brake spilled them down under into the rotors and rollers.
Oh, was it very bad?
Over 3,000 people were killed in that break. But the roads had to go on. The entire economic system hangs on the roads. They stopped now, the country would starve.
Well, isn't it possible that you've become too dependent on these roads? I mean, if your whole economy is geared to the function of one type of machinery...
The roads are foolproof now. The machinery is interlocked with an enormous safety factor.
Yes, but in the long run, machinery depends on men. What if you had a strike?
We had one back in 75. Well, there's not much danger of that anymore.
No? Well, why not?
Every cadet that goes to work on the roads today is a graduate of the United States Transport Academy. They're all picked men, screened for emotional stability, and trained to give us the same kind of loyalty that Annapolis and West Point develop in their men.
I see. Are you a graduate, Mr. Gaines?
No, I'm too old for that. The academy wasn't set up till after the strike in 75. But it won't be long now, maybe 5 or 10 years, before the oldest engineer on the roads is a man who's been through the academy. Gaines here.
Davidson, there's another trouble report from Sacramento Sector.
Again? What is it this time?
What's this? What is it? What's happened?
Emergency stop. Hello. Hello, Davidson. Phones are out. Come on.
Jake!
What is it? What's the matter with the road?
Have everybody stay in the restaurant.
What's that?
Probably somebody stepped onto the next strip. Got cut to ribbons. There'll be plenty of casualties. Jake, where's your getaway hat?
In the pantry.
Look here, Hunter. Aren't we going to help those people?
I've got the whole road to think of. Don't bother me. Give me a hand, Jake. The hatch is stuck. If you're coming with me, Mr. Evans... You've got to move fast. I haven't got any time to waste.
Where are we now?
Freeway on top of the inner road ceiling. That's the outer shell over us.
Are we going outside?
No, there'll be an access down manhole over here. They're spaced every 100 feet. There, by the green light. Now, this'll get us down on the northbound road. Careful, it's dark. Now stand away from the door, Evans.
Yes.
Come on.
But this road is still rolling.
It was only the 100-mile strip that stopped. That's what I want, a phone booth. Look out, excuse me. Look out.
Hey, I'm talking to my wife. What's the idea of busting in here?
Yeah, but emergency priority, division office.
Davidson.
Gaines here, report.
Chief, where have you been? I've been calling you.
Never mind that, report.
709, consolidated tension. Report strip 20 Sacramento sector past emergency level. Interlocks acted and cut the strip out. Cause of failure unknown. Direct communication cut to Sacramento control office. Evacuation of strip 20 commenced. No casualties.
There are casualties. I saw them. Put police and hospital routine A into operation. Get me Van Cleek. I want him to take over for me till I report in.
We can't reach him, Chief. Shall I cut out the rest of the road?
No. Keep those other strips rolling or we'll have a traffic jam the devil himself couldn't untangle. There are 5 million passengers on the road now. Notify the governor that I have assumed emergency authority. Arm all cadets available and await orders.
Shall I recall technicians off watch?
No. This isn't an engineering failure. That whole sector went out simultaneously. Somebody cut those rotors by hand. I want all available senior class cadets to report to Stockton subsector, Office 10, with pistols and tear gas.
Yes, sir. Governor wants to talk to you. He called in.
Refer him to someone else. I'm busy. I'll get back to you. I'm going down under. Evans! Evans!
I can't hear you. The noise.
Put on this helmet.
What?
Helmet! Helmet!
Oh, yes.
You can't hear without an anti-noise filter. Come on.
What are we looking for?
A recon car. There should be one here.
Are those the rotors?
No, the big ones are rotors. They drive the road. The little ones are rollers. They give continuous support. There's a watch gang now, jacking down a rotor.
Can they hear us?
No, the noise filter works on a 4-foot radius. I'll flash him. No, he sees the light.
Cadet Wilson reporting, sir.
I want your recon car, emergency.
Yes, sir, right over here, sir.
Come on, Evans.
Yes.
Now, get in.
But it's so small.
You'll fit all right. You can take off your noise filter now. Hang on, she accelerates like a rocket.
Ooh, my stomach.
Relay station.
This is Gaines. Get me Davidson, senior watch officer.
Mr. Gaines, the mayor wants to talk to you.
I haven't got time. Get me Davidson. And leave this circuit hooked into Davidson's board until I tell you to cut it.
Yes, sir. Here is the senior watch officer.
Davidson.
Gaines calling. Have you found out yet what's stopping the roads?
No, sir. It's still a mystery to me.
All right. I'm on my way in a recon car. Hold everything till I get there.
Cadet Edmonds reporting, sir. Three platoons of cadet engineers standing by with tumblebug motorcycles.
Armed?
Pistols and tear gas as ordered, sir.
Good.
Assistant Supervisor Van Cleek is calling you on Circuit 9, sir.
Van Cleek? It's about time. Cut me in.
Yes, sir.
Hello, Van. Where are you?
Sacramento office. Now, listen.
Sacramento? That's good report.
In a pig's eye.
What?
I'm not your deputy anymore, Gaines.
What are you talking about?
Listen, don't interrupt me and you'll find out. You're through, Gaines. I've been picked as director of the Engineers Control Committee. We're taking over.
Have you gone off your rotor?
We stopped Strip 20 just to give you a taste of what we can do. We're running things now.
Man, you don't really think you can get away with this.
You can't start Strip 20 until I'm ready to let you. I can stop the whole road if I have to.
Van Cleek, I'll call in the Army.
How will you get them here if the roads aren't rolling? Now, listen, Gaines. Whoever controls the roads controls the country. And right now, that happens to be me. Now, sign off, Gaines. Got to call the White House. You behave yourself and you won't get hurt.
I don't believe it, sir.
He's got us, Edmonds. We go in and blast him out, he may wreck the road. What's your rolling tonnage now?
53% under evening peak, sir.
How about strip 20?
Almost evacuated.
Listen in on this, Davidson.
Standing by, Chief.
I'm going down inside with these cadets. We'll work north, overcoming any resistance that we may meet. The watch technicians and maintenance crews are to follow behind us. Each rotor, as they come to it, is to be cut out from under Sacramento's control, then hooked into the Stockton control board. Understand?
Got it.
Check.
If it works right, we can move control of Sacramento sector right out from under Vance's feet. And he can stay in his office there till he's hungry enough to be reasonable. Edmonds, get me a pistol.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Gaines, there's a man here. He's badly hurt. He wants to see you.
Take care of him. I haven't got time.
He's from Sacramento sector.
What? Bring him in.
All right. Easy. Easy.
Mr. Gaines.
You're Harvey from the Mechanics Union, aren't you?
I tried to warn you. I tried to get away. He shot me 3 times.
Get a doctor.
All right. Easy, Harvey. How long has this been building up?
Is it the men? It's the engineers. I told them they were crazy. Told them the road's got to roll. When I tried to get away, they...
He's bleeding from the mouth, sir.
Harvey. Harvey, can you hear me?
He's dead, Mr. Gaines.
Come on, Edmonds. We better move.
Hey, Pat! All right, you men. You saw Harvey brought in. How many of you want a chance to kill the louse that did it?
I do.
Very well. You men, turn in your weapons and return to quarters. We've got a job to do to make sure the roads start rolling again. We haven't got time for infantile heroics. Anybody who hasn't got his mind on his job will be in the way. Now, here's the order. We move north, mounted on tumblebugs. We're going to try to regain control, rota by rota, before Sacramento sector knows we're moving. We've got to capture any watch personnel we run on before they can get word back. Surprise is vital. Use tear gas when possible. Shoot only when necessary. But get them before they can reach a phone jack. Any questions? No. Then move out.
What's the score, Edmonds?
33 prisoners so far, and nobody killed.
Whoops! Yes, since I rode one of these tumblebugs. Forgotten how to steer it.
Oh, sir, there's a man ahead. There at the rota base.
He's got a phone jacked in. Hurry. If he gets word back, we're sunk.
I don't think he's seen us. I'll dismount and get him.
Quick, he sees us.
Here, you.
Look out, he's got a gun.
Oh, I got him.
Grab his gun.
Yes, sir.
You had a phone jacked in, all right. If you got through to Sacramento office, it's going to be tough.
I don't know, sir. Maybe he didn't get the call through.
Wait a minute. Listen.
The road.
Pick up your noise filter. There. The road. The road is stopping. Halt your men.
Halt. Hold up there. Hold up.
There's a recon car coming up.
Station call for Mr. Gaines.
Give it to me.
Here you are, sir.
Gaines here.
Davidson here, Chief. Van Cleek's calling you.
Who stopped the road?
He did.
All right. Cut Van Cleek into me.
You thought I was fooling, huh, Gaines? What do you think now?
All right, Van, the road has stopped. You won this trick.
Then why don't you get smart and give up? You can't win.
You forgot something, Van. You can't lick the whole country.
Yeah? Gaines, I've got a switch button in my hand. If I push it, it'll blow 300 yards straight across the road. And then, for good measure, I'll take an axe and wreck the control station before I leave.
That's pretty drastic, Van.
Yeah, if I blow this charge in the middle of Sacramento sector, it'll get an awful lot of people. There are plenty of shopkeepers still on Strip 20, and that row of apartment houses next to the road will go.
Look, Van, you don't want to blow the road, neither do I. Suppose I come up to your headquarters and talk this over. Two reasonable men ought to be able to make a settlement.
Is this some kind of a trick?
I'll come alone and unarmed. My men will stay here.
All right. All right, Gaines. But one wrong move, and I blow the road.
We've got to hurry, Dave. If I take too long, Van Cleek will get edgy and set off that charge.
Failure report notes.
One, strips must be cross-connected with safety interlocks, so that when one dies, the other slow down. Two, the men.
Yeah, I can't understand it. Psych tests are rigid. We've never had a failure in the Humwadsworth-Burton method. And then suddenly a whole sector goes sour. How could Van Cleek get a whole crew of psych-cleared men to revolt?
It's easy, Dave. As my deputy, he was ex-officio personnel officer for the whole road. He must have been faking psych records for years and transferring maladjusted men into his sector.
I've got that personnel record, Mr. Gaines.
Man's record. Masked introvert. Inferiority rating 7. Comment. Despite a potential instability shown on Wadsworth Curve, this officer is especially adept in handling men. He's adept, all right. I haven't got time for any more, Dave.
You're not going up there to Sacramento, officer.
I've got to.
He'll be armed. He'll kill you.
I've got to take that chance.
But unarmed? Why don't you call him the army? He won't dare blow the road.
Yes, then. He would. Look at that psych record.
Hmm?
He's putting up a big, brave front, but he's rotten inside. He wants to be taken seriously. He wants everybody to think he's the most dangerous man in the country. And if I call the army in, he'll try to prove it by blowing the road.
How can you stop him, Mr. Gaines? He'll have a gun.
What'll you have?
What'll I have? Only a prayer. And what I know about Mr. Van Cleek.
All right, Gaines. Director Van Cleek will see you now. Gaines is here, Director Van Cleek.
Come in, Gaines. Behaving sensibly at last. You know I've got you where I want you, and there isn't anything you can do about it.
I searched him, Director. He's unarmed.
Mm-hmm. I want you to sign this now. It's a declaration of your recognition of the Engineers' Control Committee. You've got 1 minute to sign it, Gaines, or I'll push this button and blow up the whole sector.
You better sign, Gaines.
You need this gorilla with the gun, Van?
Hey, you...
Can't you handle one unarmed man alone?
All right, Harry, out.
What?
Out? Yeah. Okay. All right. Now sign. What's so funny?
You are. You start a revolution because you think the engineer should control the road. And then when you've got control, the only thing you can think of to do is blow it up. Tell me, what are you so scared of?
I'm not scared.
Yeah? Sitting there sweating all over that push button you're holding? If your buddies knew how afraid you were, they'd probably throw you into the rotors.
I'm not afraid.
You're afraid of me right now. You're afraid I'll have you on the carpet. You're afraid the cadets won't salute you. You're afraid they're laughing at you behind your back.
No, I'm not. Now, you keep quiet. I've got a gun.
You're afraid of using the wrong fork at dinner. You're afraid people are looking at you, laughing at you.
I am not, you. You dirty, stuck-up snob. Just because you went to a hi-hat school, you think you're better than anybody. You and your crummy little gold-braid cadets.
Van, you're a pathetic little shrimp.
Huh?
I understand you perfectly. You're a third rater.
Oh.
All your life, you've been afraid that someone would see through you and send you to the foot of the class.
Oh, yeah.
Throw you right out on your ear where you belong. I don't want to look at you anymore.
I'll show you. I'll put a bullet in
put
you.
Put down that pop gun before you hurt yourself.
Don't you come near me. Don't you come near me or I'll shoot.
You need that.
No. Let me go.
Get that pistol.
Ah. And thanks for not disappointing me, Van.
I don't understand.
I thought if I wounded your little ego, you'd forget to push that button and pull a trigger instead. I'm afraid you'll never make a good executive, Van. They have to know when to push buttons.
Davidson.
Gaines here.
Chief, are you all right? Are you...
I'm all right. Attack now and mop up. I'll hold the control room. I've got Van Cleek, and I think his little revolution is just about over.
Hum, watch them run. Oh, our job is never done, for our roadways go rolling along. While you ride, while you glide, we are watching down inside, so your roadways keep rolling along.
Mr. Gaines,
oh,
Mr. Gaines.
Hi,
Mr. Evans, I forgot about you. Yes, I've been waiting at the sector office. Is everything under control?
All rolling. Those are the watch engineers going under to check Sacramento's sector inch by inch.
Remarkable organization. Remarkable.
Hourly's in, Chief. San Diego Circle rolling. Bakersfield, Fresno, Stockton.
Stockton? Oh, no.
What's the matter, Chief?
Trouble, Mr. Gaines?
It sure is. I promised to meet my wife at Stockton for a show. She's been waiting there since 9 o'clock last night. Dave, see if you can get her for me. Try the sector office.
All right, Chief.
And Dave, see if you can calm her down.
Oh, sure, Chief. I'll tell her the roads must roll.
No, don't tell her that. I don't think she'd appreciate it. She's heard it too often. I better get going. Bye, Dave. Keep them rolling.
Anywhere you go, you are bound to know that your roadways go rolling along. Keep them rolling, that your roadways go rolling along. Keep them rolling, that your roadways go rolling along. Keep them rolling, that your roadways go rolling along. Keep them rolling.
You have just heard X-1, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Street and Smith, publishers of astounding science fiction. X-1 was an NBC Radio Network production.
And another break. Hopefully this will be the last one.
Yes, believe it or not, pages from the sketchbook of Robert L. Ripley. And here speaking for Bob Ripley is the Dean of Newsreel Commentators, Gregory Abbott.
Thanks, Bill Griffiths, and welcome everyone to Bob Ripley's Radio Auditorium, a collection of amazing facts discovered by Bob Ripley in his never-ending search for the truth. The truth which is always more unbelievable than fiction.
What's in the radio sketchbook today, Greg?
As usual, Bill, on page one, it's Bob Ripley's Believe It or Not quiz question. So sharpen your wits on this. Which weighs more, a pound of gold or a pound of feathers?
Oh, Greg, are you trying to pull that old chestnut on a hep character like me?
Well, Hepster, I'd advise you to think it over carefully. You may be surprised when you hear Bob Ripley's answer at the close of today's program.
Okay, but I'll bet you in an old Chinese gong that I know the answer.
Well, we'll find out later, Bill. But right now, let's see what Bob has sent us for today's radio sketchbook.
What is the topic today, Greg?
Witches.
No, what is?
That what is witches, Bill.
Oh?
Today we're going to talk about one of the most frightening phobias ever to delude mankind, witchcraft. And believe it or not, it all began with the publication of one book.
Well, what book was that?
It was written in 1484 by two men named Jacob Sprager and Henry Institor. Its title was The Witch's Hammer.
Well, what did the boys have to say about the broomstick brigadiers, Greg?
Some very nasty things, Bill. The book defined a witch as the devil himself and said that only women could be witches, thus very neatly protecting the authors themselves, who were charlatans of the evilest kind.
Well, what effect did the book have on the public?
Bill, this book opened the floodgates of all the pent-up hatred and insecurity that plagued feudal England. No sooner was it published than horrible mass executions of innocent women began. During the next 250 years, more than 1.25 million women were burned, hanged, or strangled. And usually it was simply because some fool had accused them of casting an evil eye on him. The fanaticism of the period is almost unbelievable, Bill. For example, any woman with dark hair and blue eyes could be denounced as a witch, taken out, and put to death without trial.
Well, that's horrible. Sounds almost like the type of indiscriminate slaughter the modern Nazis practiced.
In Belgium, Bill, the witch hunters burned a woman at the stake simply because she gave birth to 13 children, an unlucky number. And an innocent 7-year-old girl was strangled as a witch because she accidentally twisted her handkerchief into the shape of a mouth.
I understand there was a period of witch hunting here in America, too, Greg.
That's right, Bill. I'll tell you about one astounding case in exactly 60 seconds. But before I do, let's lend an ear to a man with a message.
One of the greatest scientific research organizations in the world is offering well-paying jobs to young men with more than average intelligence and ability. Does that make you eligible? Well, if it does, you'll want to look into the proposition thoroughly because these jobs offer unusual opportunities. The Regular Army is the scientific research organization that is one of the greatest in the world today, and you may be eligible to become a member of this compact, carefully chosen force of skilled technicians. There's opportunity for you to get well on your way toward a successful civilian career, receiving training that is second to none in such modern fields as radar, diesel engines, electronics, photography, aviation specialties, and many others. Today's regular Army man is a skilled professional who works with advanced techniques and equipment in at least one of many specialized fields. So ask for full information about the advantages of joining in our modern peacetime Army at the recruiting office nearest you. Now back to Bob Ripley's Radio Auditorium.
Greg, you were telling us that witch hunting was practiced even here in America.
Yes, Bill. In the old town of Salem, Massachusetts, in the year 1692, 32 women met horrible deaths as witches. And believe it or not, as recently as 1930, during the national census, two women actually reported their profession as practicing witches, believe it or not.
Well, Greg, I see now it's time for Bob Ripley's Believe It or Not dramatic sketch. And I suppose the topic is witch hunting.
And a very important bit of witch hunting it was, too, as you'll soon find out. But now let me set the scene for you. The time is 200 years ago. The city of London is being plagued by an epidemic of ague, a disease much like malaria. Our scene opens on a dark and stormy night in March. At the door of a tiny cottage on the outskirts of the city, a father, carrying a tiny bundle, raps cautiously on the door.
Mother Saunders! Mother Saunders!
Who raps on the door of Mother Saunders' cottage at this hour of the night?
Open up, please!
Well, what do you want?
Mother Saunders, I'm Peter Grimes. They told me that you could cure the ague.
So they told you that, huh?
They say you have a magic talisman what drives the sickness away.
Are you sick?
Not I, it's my baby. This morning she wouldn't eat, took to crying. Then this afternoon she got all blue and began to shake like an aspen tree. Will you cure her?
Come in, shut the door, quickly.
I can't pay you much.
Whatever you can give Mother Saunders is enough. I do not covet money.
Then you'll cure her.
First, you must make a promise.
Anything.
Promise that you'll tell no one you came to see Mother Saunders. First thing you know, they'll be accusing me of witchcraft. Promise, or I'll put a hex on you that'll cross your eyes.
I promise anything but help my baby.
Set her down upon this table.
There.
Now turn her about three times and spit to the west.
One, two, three. Just done.
And now for the charm.
You're certain the devils won't get her?
Stop shaking and fasten this talisman to her wrist. Quickly! She's turning blue.
She don't look right.
Fasten the talisman, whilst I light this incense.
All right. For heaven's sake, hurry. She's choking.
All right. Spirit, out of the wrist. Out of this baby. Turn and twist. Out with the ague. But now, hist. There. She's made.
Look at her. She looks so strange. You've killed her. She's dead.
No, it cannot be.
She's dead. Look at her. She's dead. And you've hexed her. You witch. You've hexed my child.
The baby's superstitious father, certain that Margaret Saunders had cast an evil eye on his child, went straight to the Crown Prosecutor Peter Warburton. Within a week, all London was astir with another of the witchcraft trials so rampant during those troubled times. As our next scene opens, the jury has just returned to the court where Sir Philip York, Lord Chief Justice of the Bench, is presiding.
Order in the court! Order! Proceed with your questioning, Mr. Warburton.
Thank you, Your Honor. Now, Margaret Saunders, you admit that on the night of March the 4th, you did receive at your cottage this man, Peter Grimes, who brought to you a child sick of the ague.
I do not deny it.
And you also admit that you did treat this child with all manner of incantations, utterances, talismans, and other devices of witchcraft.
I am not a witch.
Margaret Saunders, you admit that you used a certain talisman to treat the child.
I have treated hundreds of children and cured them, too.
Answer the question. Did you use a talisman?
Yes.
Now, Margaret Saunders, remember, you are sworn to tell the truth. Admit, you received this talisman from none other than Satan himself. Admit it.
No, it is not true.
Margaret Saunders, you are in league with the devil. Admit it.
No.
Gentlemen of the court, look how she cringes before good and honest men. I tell you, gentlemen, she received this talisman from the devil himself, and she's used it to bewitch and murder that little child. Gentlemen, there's only one verdict for this creature. Death!
Murder! Kill the witch! Kill the witch! Margaret Saunders, you will rise and face the jury. Mr. Juryman, what is your verdict?
We find the defendant, Margaret Saunders, guilty of witchcraft.
Order! Order in this court! Margaret Saunders, you realize the serious nature of this verdict, that it carries the sentence of death.
Aye. If I'm to die, then I'm to die. But I've done naught. People came to me to help them out of their suffering, and I helped them. I had a talisman, but it was a good talisman, and it cured them.
And you still insist that you did not receive this talisman from the devil?
Your Honor, I protest post facto questioning of the defendant. She's been found guilty.
Mr. Warburton, I am conducting this court. Certain of our eminent physicians have asked me to try and find out how this talisman was used. It seems Margaret Saunders did effect several cures, whether she is a witch or not.
I yield to the court.
Now, Margaret Saunders, tell me how you came to get this talisman.
Well, Your Honor, it was given me many years ago by a young gentleman.
When and how?
It was more than 30 years ago. I had a little girl then, and she fell sick with the ague. The doctors could do nothing to help her.
Where does this young gentleman come in?
My father owned an inn. This young gentleman stopped there one night and asked for lodgings and food. Next day he heard that my daughter was sick. He told me he had a magic talisman that could cure her. I was desperate, Your Honor, so I let him try. He took a small piece of parchment and wrote on it.
You say he wrote upon a piece of parchment and gave it to you?
Yes, Your Honor. I have the parchment here. You see, it is rolled up and tied with colored ribbons. He told me to fasten it to my little girl's wrist.
Stop. I think I can explain what happened. This young gentleman stopped at the inn without money to pay for his lodgings. When he heard about the sick daughter, he saw a way to take advantage of the mother's anguish and so avoid paying for his meals. So he took the parchment, and on it he wrote some meaningless gibberish. Margaret Saunders, you have that talisman with you, do you not?
Yes, Your Lordship.
Give it to Mr. Warburton here.
I'll not touch it.
It's quite safe, I assure you, Warburton. If you'll take it and open it, you will find written on it the first 5 letters of the Greek alphabet. They are entirely meaningless.
Very well. Why, you're right, Your Honor. But how could you know? The talisman was wrapped up.
Because, Mr. Warburton, I was the young man in the inn who wrote those letters.
Believe it or not, Judge Philip York was the young man who 30 years before had given Margaret Saunders the worthless bit of paper as a cure for her daughter's ague. And believe it or not, that talisman not only apparently cured her child, but also hundreds of others during those years. The astonishing confession by the judge that he, and not the devil, had given her the talisman resulted in the acquittal of Margaret Saunders. And this case so aroused public opinion that from that day forward, witchcraft trials were abolished in England. Believe it or not.
Now for the answer to today's quiz question.
Well, Bill, did you get the answer to Bob Ripley's question? Which weighs more, a pound of feathers or a pound of gold?
Oh, that's easy. You can't fool me. A pound is a pound. They both weigh the same. Think I'm a child, right?
Well, Junior, I'll tell you. A pound of feathers actually weighs more than a pound of gold.
How come?
Well, that's because feathers are weighed by avoirdupois measure, which has 16 ounces to the pound, while gold is weighed by troy measure, which only has 12 ounces to the pound, believe it or not.
Okay, Greg, you win. And that takes us right down to the finish line. So how about one of Bob Ripley's famous farewells?
All right, Bill. In keeping with the spirit of witches, fairies, and leprechauns, Bob Ripley has asked me to say goodbye to our audience in the words of old Rip Van Winkle. Here's to your good health, and here's to your family's good health. May they live like happy gnomes and prosper like fairy kings.
Believe it or not.
Well, I guess we've come to the end of the so-called dramatic presentation portion of Night Transmissions, and we're going to fade off here into music. But before I do that, I want to remind everybody that you can write me at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. You know, it's not like I know what I'm doing here, so if you have any suggestions or you just want to tell me where to go, feel free. If you have an old radio show that you remember that's in this vein that we do here, tell me about it. I'll see if I can find it and play it. I'd also like to encourage you to visit the website, which is where the show notes are kept. The website, not surprisingly, is www.nighttransmissions.com. Night Transmissions is one word. No space or underscore or anything between the night and the transmission. Just Night Transmissions. Okay, well, I'm going to shut up now. I think I mentioned before that my mother always told me that if you don't think too good, you shouldn't think too much. I've always taken that to heart. And I've extended that to think that perhaps if you don't host too good, you shouldn't host too much. I hope you won't hold that against me and will continue to drop by and listen to these old radio programs.
You lie in gentle sleep beside me. I hear your warm and rhythmic breathing. I take your hand and hold it tightly. Listen, can you not hear our young hearts beating? I kiss the sleep from your eyes. Your smile is sweeter than the morning. And I hear it come. Can't you feel it, baby? Can't you feel it? I hear it come. Feel it. Feel it. Fire. Fire. Something's burning. Something's burning. Something's burning. And I think it's love. The sun is burning brightly. We lie in love so close together. I get the feeling deep inside me. My love for you will burn forever. I cup my hands to touch your face, and once again I feel your fire. It's love, and I think it's love.
Into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire.
I went down, 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 and the flames went higher, and it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. Fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. The taste of love is sweet when hearts like ours meet. I fell for you like a child. Oh, but the fire went wild. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
The flames, they followed Joan of Arc as she came riding through the dark. No moon to keep her armor bright, no man to get her through the smoky night. She said, I'm tired of the war. I want the work I had before. A wedding dress or something white to wear upon my swollen appetite. To hear you talk this way, I've watched you riding every day, and something in me yearns to win such a cold and lonesome heroine. And who are you? The smoke. I am fire, he replied, and I love your solitude, and I love your pride. La la la. She stepped inside to be into his fiery heart. He took the dust of Joan of Arc and high above the wedding guests he hung the ashes of her wedding dress. La la la. If he was fire, then she must be wood. I saw her wince, I saw her cry, saw the glory in her eye. Myself, I long for love and light, but must it come so cruel? Must it be so bright? La 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 la.
Sometimes it's like someone took a knife, baby, edgy and dull, and cut a 6-inch valley through the middle of my skull. At night I wake up with the sheets soaking wet and a freight train running through the middle of my head. Only you can cool my head.